insofar as it almost seemed like the director trying to get a certain performance out of like
a difficult woman.
Like a very difficult actress that and she's not really going by the script or by what the audience wants in a way.
That's very funny. It wasn't Joe Helen, but it is. It's a very funny idea.
So, well, how do you think that? I mean, does Tony Blair still view the Queen in a way as sort of a mother figure, or are there those echoes of his own, or at least of his mother's generation,
Mothers are quite difficult to deal with. I thought that was the best training in the world. Not that he had the opportunity, but. Yes, it's difficult getting strong women of independent minds to sort of do what you want them to do. It's tricky. He's also a sort of well polite public school boy, and there's his place, as it were. And I imagine that he didn't want, I should think what he was really scared of is that there'd be this huge public event in London and people would start booing the Queen in front of the world's cameras. Yeah.
Mm. There's a story about things that were maybe left out. There was one moment that I was very surprised wasn't in your movie, because when I saw it really happen, I thought, I've never seen this happen before. It was when the Queen and all the royal family stood outside of Buckingham Palace when the hearse came by.
Yes, that was, I was keen to put that in. There were two television stations covered it. ITV missed the shot. ITV, for whom we were making the film, missed the shot. The BBC got the shot. The BBC then, the BBC are terrified of losing their relationship with the palace. So the BBC stopped me using it. When you point out to them that you're actually paying the Queen a compliment, they fail to understand what you're talking about. So yes, but don't blame me, blame the BBC.
So did you get the impression that people thought you were going to do kind of a smear job on the royal family? Is that why you kind of ran into some resistance like this?
That was actually, to be fair, that was the only incident. And it was just unfortunate the ITV camera was behind the car, so you didn't actually see the event. and suddenly it comes down to sort of one event, and people aren't clear-headed enough to be able to deal with it intelligently.
Mm-hmm. But I think one of the reasons that people have responded to the film in the way that they have in England, and the response has been pretty bizarre.
Wonderful, phenomenal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Bizarre in that it wasn't what anybody expected.
Well, bizarre in that dyed-in-the-wool, when I say Republicans, I mean anti-monarchists. Dyed-in-the-wool anti-monarchists come out all gooey. It's connected in some shape or form with some part of the national subconscious and psyche, and in a way that one couldn't have predicted. And to answer your question, I mean, actually, it is the tenderness, or I doubt the Queen would see it that way, but it is the sort of, as it were, the responsibility with which we've treated the task, and as it were, the compassion, rather than, I mean, to see a hatchet job, I mean, I think people would probably sort of, do I really want to go to the cinema to see either the government or the monarchy slaughtered by clever, clever filmmakers? And it is our refusal to do that that possibly has really connected to people, and that's been the surprise. I mean, it's been a number of people have said, God, I would never have expected anybody to make such a traditional film, but I think what we're trying to do is so new, which is to treat our leaders as three-dimensional, complex, and intelligent human beings. The idea of that in a tradition where, since Hogarth, we've had nothing but vicious satire, is in itself, quite revolutionary.
Just to finish, when Diana did the panorama interview, what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the palace weren't best pleased, and so they transferred their affection from the BBC to ITV, and I think the BBC were rather startled by this, and therefore didn't want to displease the palace.
The film is also very complimentary, at least from an American point of view, to Tony Blair, who, as far as we know, is so very unpopular at the moment in Britain. Do you think that this film will help ease, in a way, his sort of transition, that people will remember more of the positive things that he did than towards the end of his term?
Do you want to answer?
I doubt it.
Yeah. No, certainly not judging by the rounds of applause that the line always seems to get when she says, and one day it'll happen to you, Mr. Blair. Everyone just cheers at that bit. So firstly, that's the other. But secondly, again, it's down to this business. I mean, both Stephen and I are profoundly disappointed and angry, with and at Tony Blair. And we're not alone. I mean, just about everybody in the country feels that way, particularly all the people that felt all the hope. And I think to remind somebody of the hope that we'd felt of somebody and how great they'd been. I mean, Tony Blair, when he walked in, was like the Messiah. And for us, for us to paint him as something other than that would have just been untrue. I mean, at that moment in 1997, he was absolutely flying high. The only moment that I think he flew even higher than this was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when he sort of, as it were, became, he could articulate what George Bush clearly couldn't. Mm-hmm. And, that was possibly his finest moment. And, so in other words, for us to paint a picture of a deranged neocon inside the new Labour administration was, that wouldn't make sense. Also, if you do the opposite, it often has the desired effect. That is to say, if you paint a picture of how popular a guy was, it only makes one more aware of quite how far they've come. Whereas if you attack somebody, people instinctively, because they're intelligent and have their own minds, start counterbalancing, and they start immediately going, well, actually, he isn't that bad, and I don't like the filmmakers telling me he's like that. You know what I mean? So actually, if you tell people he's good, they sort of go, no, he isn't. Which is sort of a desired effect.
Do either of you guys have a relationship with the speechwriter, the one who wrote the term the People's Princess? And has he seen it? And has that any of those people in his circle seen the film and reacted to it?
In his circle, absolutely. He himself, no, because he's saving it all for his memoirs. So he was one of the few people that didn't talk to me, even though I'm sure he was gagging to. Alistair Campbell. I'm quite happy to say he didn't talk to me, and just about everybody that worked for him did.
Now you've written
so
both.
Watch your back, Alistair.
You've written both Last Game Scotland now and The Queen, both of them about two rulers whose part of their job, in a way, is to not show who they are to the people, to present a certain image of themselves, whether it's as a strong man and as a hero of the people, or as this sort of stalwart presence. What's, lack of a better way of putting it, what's kind of the trick to nailing a story like that? Is it just tons of research, or is it simply just...
Well, if you look at any leader, and I don't think... I mean, I think this links most of them. Once they get elected, rather, or once they murder the people in power at the moment and take over, the business becomes about staying in power. And so, actually, although you may have a manifesto, these are the things that we will do once we're in, yes, very few people then get in and think, right, now I will go back to my manifesto and do everything that I promised. They actually they become consumed with the business of, I am in power, how do I stay in power? And I have to say that, the politics of survival is something that links Tony Blair, Idi Amin, the Queen. These people are in, they're all defined by their need to survive. And so they change, and then the relationship between leaders and the people they lead is really complex. There's a really interesting push and a pull. Sometimes you lead, sometimes you follow, even as a leader. And in this instance, I think it's quite interesting that this is one instance where the Queen had to follow, and Blair had to follow. Blair, rather like the second Clinton term, it was sort of predicated on an idea of, I want to hear what the people want, I want to respond to it, rather than, this is what I want to give the people and they will respond. Wait a minute, why don't I just find out what people want and see how I can give it to them? And in this particular instance, Blair was responding quite pragmatically, I suppose, to grow, this is what they want, it's clear what they want, let's give it to them, otherwise there'll be trouble. And, Amin had a different way of solving that, rather than necessarily giving people what he wanted. He fed them to crocodiles. But I mean, in both cases, there is an interesting, complex reason for why people become who they are. They aren't born how they become, and how people become who they are is often a neglected story.
Stephen, can you talk a little about casting James Cromwell as Prince Philip? Boy, Prince Philip doesn't come across very nice in this film. Is he really that bad?
Well, in England, he's a lovable fascist. Phil the Greek. He's always going out for kebabs. He's a sort of comic figure. Always putting his foot in it. Rather endearing.
Okay.
I'm sure that he's more than that. I'm sure there's, well, first of all, I'd assume there's some truth in the jokes, and he's more than that. And casting Jim somehow gave you an opportunity to get at something slightly more substantial than just having a sort of pantomime villain.
History shows also that, you know, you are the exception amongst American educated American ladies who to find Philip unattractive, because we're led to believe, particularly if we read the Kitty Kelly book, that he has all manner of dalliances with
liaisons.
Well, I mentioned this movie. I thought he comes across as heartless, almost taking. Did they really take
the
kids?
Could you?
Did they really take the kids?
The kids hunting the day after.
Yes, but you have to think to yourself: is that an unreasonable thing to do? Mm-hmm. It's like going outside, going walking. They're angry. A lot of people. I mean, I don't know. Is that more unreasonable than going to a pub, drinking yourself stupid, and coming home and beating your wife? I mean, do you know what I mean? It's like people behave. When I try and defend people going stalking or hunting afterwards, I just say that's an aristocratic way of dealing with your feelings, not to talk about it, to suppress it, to go out and take it out on an animal. They don't feel the way that we do, possibly, about animals.
But it's not necessarily indifference.
That's my point.
I mean, if they were like lower middle class, wouldn't they have just stuck the kids in front of the video games or the TV?
Exactly.
Are they just doing
Then numb them out with pizzas and Game Boy. Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about what was the most useful resource to make this film? It's kind of, I laughed so much when Tony Blair was kind of meeting first time the Queen. That is so funny, but it was kind of accurate, and Helen Mirren's Queen, she's so real. You guys kind of try to kind of use this kind of useful resource to make an accurate kind of. It's fantasy, it's a fiction movie, but it's kind of more kind of documentary.
Well, we don't really know how accurate it is. You know, we're finding out now, but we'll never know how accurate that scene is, because neither person will tell, and nobody else is present.
You have to put yourself...
You set a sort of plausibility test, which we seem to have passed.
Also, you could ask yourself, look, it is absolutely gaga what goes on in the palace. The minute you go to the palace, you get a protocol sheet, and the protocol sheet tells you how to behave. Now, Tony Blair is a highly sophisticated and educated man, you know, as are all of us, I imagine, but I guarantee you that every single one of us, if we went to the palace, would start behaving like gibbering idiots, because we'd be thrown, there's a whole new rule set, a whole new, you know, when you see these people go to get their, as it were, their CBEs or their honours. You knock twice, you walk in, you bow, you do, you kneel, you wait, you wait, you extend your hand, you then lower, you don't kiss, you bend, you bow, you look up, you didn't learn, and you're so frightened, you're in a suit, and you're not sure, do I bow, do I kneel, do I say hello, when do I speak, how do I address her, is it ma'am, mum, you're paralysed. So even Tony Blair, who'd met her on previous occasions, also the historical importance of what you're doing, you're sitting in the same chair that all prime ministers sat in since Churchill. So... wouldn't it turn anybody to jelly? I think it would.
I was curious that after that very explicit direction by the protocol manager that it's ma'am as in ham, that I distinctly heard mom.
One point, made a mistake.
Many times?
I apologize. No, once. There is one. I apologize.
It's a Freudian slip, though, because the whole idea that she is kind of a surrogate mother to him, I mean, it's kind
of
Freudian.
Yeah,
so it kind of works.
Yes.
But I did want to ask you a little bit more about Helen, because I mean her performance is so incredible. You kind of forget you're watching Helen Mirren and you believe you're
watching. That's what she said.
So tell me a little bit about working with her. I mean, what was she like, and what was it about her that
you turn up and you drop on one knee and you don't back your way out of the room and curtsy quite a lot. She's great. Mm. If you're working with people that talented and that bright, it's easy. Mm. It's when they're not that talented and bright, that's when the problems start. Mm-hmm. She's a highly intelligent woman. And also, it is like, you know, there's such a common pool of, because we all have lived with the Queen all our lives, you kind of know what the game is. I mean, then on top of that, there is a level, of course, where you're being imaginative. But there's a great body of common experience. You know, we know the way she walks, talks, all those things. It's like a given, and the actors love doing all of that. Then on top of it, you're being imaginative, and then that's really being steered where the script is taking to you. So often, the most constructive conversations were about editing the text. I don't think she'd say that. Should it go that way rather than that way? And that's where you're really making decisions.
Mm-hmm. I'm very keen on seeing The Deal, which I've never seen, and I don't think it's available on DVD.
It's about British domestic politics, isn't it? I mean, no, you shouldn't laugh. There's no reason why. Again, you're making a film where everybody in Britain knows everything. You're not somehow, there are no bodies in the third act. Well, there was a body in the third act, but that, there aren't surprises. You're dealing with stuff that everybody knows. To make it for a foreign audience, you're having to explain things. You say, look, actually, this is going on, it means this and this and this. So by making it for television, we didn't go through that process. We didn't think we had anything to export. There didn't seem to be any reason why anybody else in the world, I don't mean individuals, I mean, but seriously, should be interested in this subject. With the Queen, clearly people all around the world are interested in the Queen. You don't need to be a genius to spot that.
You know, in the same sense, though, I was thinking that perhaps maybe 50 years hence, because you don't do a lot of explaining about the Queen's reservations about Diana's judgment, about her sense that she had undermined the dignity of the monarchy, and so on. So.
Well, we did more explaining in The Queen than we did in The Deal. for precisely those reasons. Because
and the news people say, again, her judgment question.
Well, it was also more complicated than that, because you're making a film about a woman who famously doesn't display her feelings, doesn't wear them on her sleeve, doesn't make a sort of fetish of them. You know, this is not a good place to start from when you're making a film where the character herself sort of makes a business of being unknowable. So frequently we would find that in the writing, you would have to, in the previous scenes, explain the story, as it were, and then Helen didn't have to do any explaining for herself because the character wouldn't explain. Mm-hmm. That's always a problem in films.
Do you have any special plans for the DVD?
I just make the bloody things.
Well, I thought usually when you do the PR tour, right. You also do the narration for the DVD. That's the
oh,
what
I see.
Many people do, anyway.
Well, we are simple fisherfolk. We
was there at any time any consideration of putting more of Diana's sons in the movie? Like an additional scene or anything with them beyond just the...
It seemed to me, listen, in the end, two children lost their mother. You know, you sort of... And see, that's where you draw a line, right, I suppose.
You've mentioned a couple times where you don't know exactly what the truth is, and you've heard, you know, a few people. What is the ratio of things that are true, that aren't true, that are maybe more for the movie, or is it...
Well, you're certainly... It's not quite the way you describe. You're certainly serving two masters, that you're trying to make a story and constructing it and... You know, dealing with the things that making a story film always involves. And you're also trying to be truthful. You're trying to create a plausible account of the events. And truth is anyway very, very mysterious. If, you know, there are things in the film that are known, which are true, which I regret. I can think of one thing that was in The Deal. So truth is a complicated thing. So imagination is more interesting. And what we've learnt from the response to the film in England, we sort of have got it right. I mean, there was an extraordinary piece by Diana's secretary who described how he went to sneer and see how they got it all wrong, came away thinking, well, I wouldn't know how you made a better film about it. So we've been, you know, no one's turned up and said it wasn't like that.
Could you tell me who wrote that, the name of the person who wrote that piece, and maybe I can find it?
It was called Patrick Jephson, Jephson. And it was in The Spectator.
Now, when Helen was in here, she said that she thought that the national outpouring of grief over Diana's death was became more about the people on the street than it did about them, that it was kind of almost a circus mentality had kind of overtaken, and that kind of struck me, because if you know everybody's had that member in their family that kind of became a headache, and even so, just imagine if you're within your own family and your sister-in-law, whatever, is now out of the family by virtue of divorce, and she dies, and you have a bunch of strangers on your front lawn saying, why aren't you giving her a big state funeral? I mean, when it just seems like, did it really, do you think that the grieving over Diana really became more about the people that didn't really know her?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, that's why I put that line in that Charles goes, you know, their Diana and ours are two completely different people. You know, I think that to the people outside, she was a tragic figure and a beautiful woman and, you know, seemed to modernise the royal family in some way. And I think in living with her, I think history is now, there was a book written called After Diana, which was a collection of essays, you know, written by sort of pretty tasty intellectuals and academics and cultural commentators, and they wrote it in the immediate aftermath of Diana's death, and, you know, it held her up as this sort of iconic feminist radical revolutionary, you know.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the people who wrote stuff like that in the immediate aftermath of her death are probably a bit embarrassed about themselves now, because I think with time, I think, you know, just in hindsight, people just look back and, you know, it was quite a disturbed and unhappy and quite a lost person, really.
Do you think it's just the power of celebrity trumping the power of royalty in a way? Because, I mean, I thought it was really brilliant that you didn't have an actress playing Diana. You used all real footage, and you really get that sense of power of celebrity.
When we shot the Paris sequence, we did actually have a look at
her. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And you see the top of her head.
Yeah.
And she did look rather like her, particularly one profile. But as soon as you put a shot in of her, that was all people were interested in. Does she look like her? The film collapsed at that point, because anyone watching it just became obsessed with the degree of her, whether she looked like her, whether she didn't look, whatever it was. That was the only subject for discussion, which arises with none of the other people. Nobody sits around saying, does Alex look like Charles or whatever it is. They just sort of get on with it. But at that precise moment, that was all people were interested in.
Yeah. JFK in that way, and then where they only used like real footage of JFK and everybody else.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Quite right.
Talking about the Helen Mirren, she's as you said, she's so queen. So did you guys kind of hire the technical advisor or something like that who knows about her in person, or did you guys give some the book or some kind of papers?
There's a lot of film of the Queen. You know, Helen's very thorough. I would have done her research and looked at a lot of film and read the books, and I'm sure talked to people. You know.
Peter, why do you obviously lived with this for so many so long? Why do you think, just your own judgment, in retrospect, why Diana made such a colossally idiotic decision to hook up with Jody Al-Fayed, given his character? And was it a deliberate rebuke to her former family? Was it a way of saying F you? What was that?
I think it had a lot to do with protection. I think, you know, the Fayeds, you know, have an enormous personal security detail, and I think they flattered her. And they also, you know, and it's ironic given the demise, they also promised her that they could protect her. And I don't know if it was an act of FU to the royals or not, but I do remember when I heard that she'd died or she'd been in this crash, I remember not being surprised, not because I thought that she would crash, but I remember thinking the circumstances of her life had become so eccentric and insane, really.
Disturbed.
Disturbed. You know, she was smuggling other boyfriends in the boot of her car. There were all these other people that had been proposed
to. There was a bloke in Pakistan.
There was Asnat Khan.
Mm.
And then there was, you know, a former rugby player coming in the boot. I don't know. And she was flying in helicopters to go see spiritualists. She was really lost. Really, really lost. And sometimes when people dash around and they change their plans and they... Sometimes it takes, you know, often in situations like that, they'll have a... they'll get really ill or something. Something slows them down.
Why do you think there's so many? Well, I don't know how many of yours. The conspiracy theories in London. I know that's his father who believes that, but the other people did. My office in London said to me, "Oh, they killed her."
His father saw the film.
People like to think that, yeah.
All she had to do was put on a seatbelt.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody didn't make her not put on a seatbelt.
His father saw the film.
Yeah, his father saw the film. What did he say?
Well, given that there wasn't actually a scene in which Prince Philip strangled his son in the tunnel, he actually thought it was extremely fair.
What was the reaction of her brother?
The Spencer family, yeah.
We haven't heard, but he gave permission. Okay. It was interesting about Spencer. He had to give permission to use the bits. And also there was a discussion about whether he should be played by an actor. Well, no actor could have been as powerful as the real material. So I didn't entertain the idea, but it was actually discussed, and he did give permission.
And
3 weeks later, he was divorced from cruelty to his wife.
Last question.
You haven't heard from them since it's coming.
He hasn't rung me up, no.
Do you think the kind of celebrity culture that Diana was caught up in, and that her son seemed to be kind of part of, whether they try to be or not, has that irreparably harmed the monarchy? Could there ever be other monarchs kind of as
well,
a worm.
I don't think you should automatically use the word harm. That is to say, you know, it's like films. They reflect the times we live in. And if people want films to be the way they are now, they have every right to be. And that's got a sort of, you know, it's got a sort of demotic quality about it. So if the royal family's children like pop music, that's just life. That's just... Yeah. The world moving on, and it might not best please the Queen, but so what?
Except they don't.
I think anybody looking
for William and Harry to be beacons of a new generation will be sorely disappointed. I think these are extraordinarily conservative country boys who grow up shooting stag.
Even when
they've just gone from public school to the army. Hello. I'm really looking forward to the revolution.
Are you happy to hear about the reception that Helen in particular has gotten about her performance in the film? That there's talk about her getting nominations and things like that. She was kind of reluctant to speak, you know, kind of that British
reserve
thing.
We're British. We don't talk about things like that, but if she doesn't get nominated, I'll kill various people.
Is it easier to get permission from Spielberg or Tom Hanks and these kind of famous people?
I don't think we have to ask. I don't mean that impertinently. I just think it's newsreel footage.
He went.
Yes. No, I didn't. He's really good in the film, isn't he?
He did exactly what we asked.
Yes. He flew in.
I've cut my rate.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.